That's right. If we can get through them, we believe we can.
Okay, and so, 15 minutes prior to perhaps. Okay, we'll start, I'll turn it over to Mr. Manager.
Well, thank you. We'd like to begin with a report on the health impact assessment on transit. You'll remember we did some work previous on this and a sort of larger, writ large concept, and then drilled into transit as a specific area to consider using this tool of health impact assessment. So with us today are Jason Wilcox and Lisa Goldschmidt. Thanks for coming. I'm going to ask them to lead us through the report.
Sure. Thanks, Mike, and thank you, Council. Again, my name is Jason Wilcox. I'm the Health Impact Assessment Coordinator at the Columbia Boone County Department of Public Health and Human Services.
I'm Lisa Goldschmidt. I'm the Comet Campaign Coordinator.
And this presentation will demonstrate the findings and recommendations of the Transportation Utility Fee Health Impact Assessment. And this, again, as Mike stated, is a follow-up to our first health impact assessment we did last year on an expanded transit system. The project was funded by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, specifically the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps to Health program. The HIA was conducted by the HIA partner team, and that is staff from the Department of Public Health and Human Services, Central Missouri Community Action, or CMCA, the PetNet Coalition, and we had representation from advocacy, community organizations, local government, and also Columbia residents. Just a little bit of background. In 2011, Columbia Transit faced budget cuts and higher fuel costs combined with increased student ridership, leading it to increase fares and change its routes and services to accommodate more riders. Public support, led by the Comet Campaign for Transit, helped to mitigate some of the proposed cuts. During 2012, the HIA partner team conducted Columbia's first health impact assessment on the health effects of expanding and improving the bus service. There was no evidence to suggest negative outcomes concerning expanded transit. Based on a city council request, we performed a second health impact assessment to identify potential health outcomes of a utility fee designed specifically to fund public transportation, known as a transportation utility fee, or TUF. Briefly just talking about what is a health impact assessment. Community health is influenced by policies and programs from other domains such as education, transportation, and urban development. A health impact assessment, or HIA, is an evidence-based research tool used when proposed policies, programs, or projects are under active consideration to inform decision makers about the potential health risks and benefits of their proposals. Health impact assessment provides recommendations to minimize negative health outcomes and maximize positive ones, but it is simply for informative purposes only. It is not an advocacy tool. HIAs for more complex decisions generally require more time for literature reviews, gathering of expert and stakeholder opinions, collection of new primary data, and informing decision makers, although this HIA also included those actions, and we performed this between February and May of this year. The project goals were to, first, number one, assess the potential health effects of funding expanded public transit in Columbia via a designated transportation utility fee, determine the likelihood of these health effects given the best possible evidence, and number three, to provide recommendations for how funding transit expansion can maximize positive and minimize negative health outcomes. The HIA partner team determined the research question to be, how will a monthly transportation utility fee affect low and fixed income households? The partner team identified four health-related indicators most likely to be affected by the addition of a transportation utility fee and a decrease in the resident's income. And these four indicators were food insecurity, stress, health care access, and housing conditions and security. Our assessment included a variety of data sources such as literature reviews, a community-based survey conducted in partnership with Columbia Transit, of which we had over 450 responses from the community, and interviews with stakeholders from local health and social service agencies. The population targeted by the HIA is individuals and families up to 150% of federal poverty guidelines, which for a family of three is approximately $29,000 per year. Columbia's current poverty rate is approximately 19%, affecting approximately 11,000 of 48,000 households. Also included in the target population are fixed income households such as seniors. The population was identified using data from energy assistance resources in Boone County, Low-Income Household Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, is a federally funded program. It is only available to individuals and families at or below 135% federal poverty guidelines. Winter 2012 LIHEAP funds for Boone County totaled over $651,000, and there were over 2,700 applicants. These populations also rely on Energy Crisis Intervention Program, or ESIP funds, which are separate altogether from LIHEAP funds. They totaled over $340,000 during the winter of 2012, and ESIP served approximately over 1,000 Columbia households that season after residents received either a disconnect notice on their energy or had been turned off. Additionally, energy assistance contributions made by the City of Columbia, which again are separate from LIHEAP and ESIP, extend to 150% federal poverty guidelines and are donated through the cash and help programs. During winter 2012, over 300 Columbia households were helped. City utility assistance is available to a household one time per calendar year, and the maximum amount of aid is $100. Most public transit systems in the United States do not make a profit off of fares alone, so systems rely on federal and state subsidies to help fund operations. However, subsidies have decreased over time, and more transit systems are relying on local sources of transportation funding. Popular local sources of funding include transportation sales taxes, taxes on gasoline, and property taxes. The recent economic downturn has made local funding sources potentially unsustainable, so some jurisdictions have turned to a new alternative form of funding called a transportation utility fee. Like water and sewer systems, users are charged a transportation utility fee to connect their share of the cost to the benefit they receive from the transportation system. The fee is most often based on the number of trips that are generated. Properties that contribute more trips generate a higher fee per month. Fees are based on standards established in the Trip Generation Manual published by the Institute for Transportation Engineers. Residential rates are normally determined by unit, either by single-family or multifamily homes, and commercial rates are usually determined per 1,000 square feet of property. Different jurisdictions nationwide use fees between $1.50 and $6 per month. Our HIA assists single-family homes a $4 per month fee, and multifamily homes a $2 per month fee. And we use a fee structure similar to the transportation fee used in Hillsboro, Oregon, for our commercial properties. Under this model, the total amount raised from a transportation utility fee would be over $3.7 million per year, with 54% of that allocation coming from commercial properties and 46% from residential properties. The transportation utility fee, combined with the transportation sales tax and matching federal assistance, would potentially provide Columbia Transit an additional 3,500 hours in operations per year. There are a number of annual fixed route service increases that could potentially occur, and here are only a few examples. The easiest route increase would be to add 8 hours of Sunday service. Adding additional service hours on weekdays or reducing headways during peak hours are more expensive options, but would allow for earlier and or later service. A final example would be a reduction of the current 40-minute weekday peak hour headways to 20 minutes by adding buses on each route. A caveat to any increase in service is that the current bus drivers would work more often or additional drivers would need to be hired. Other capital purchases would also need to be made, such as adding more buses to the current fleet and providing fuel. Although it is beyond the scope of this project, Columbia Paratransit hours would also need to increase by an equal number.
Review of the literature and input from key informants and community members strongly suggests that what may seem like an insignificant fee to some, $2 to $4 monthly, could further harm the most vulnerable Columbia residents. The costs of food, energy, higher education, housing, and health care increased during the recent economic downturn. These added expenses disproportionately burden low-income and fixed-income families. By decreasing families' disposable income, the fee could negatively affect the type and amount of food they purchase. Families face a heat or eat dilemma because they prioritize housing costs and utilities over food. Families who decrease their food expenses by altering their eating patterns are considered food insecure, defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as not having enough access to food for an active, healthy life. Boone County has a food insecurity rate of about 12%. Over 23,000 residents are food insecure, including more than 7,000 children. The most obvious immediate effect of food insecurity is hunger, but the long-term effects include higher risk of disease, stunted development, increased risk of death, reduced productivity at work and school, unemployment and income loss, increased health care costs, and greater demand for public services and benefits. The $2 transportation utility fee is equivalent to a week of school lunches for a child in the free and reduced lunch program. There are approximately 6,500 Columbia Public School children receiving free and reduced lunches as of October 2012. Staff at CNCA said the fee could be a breaking point for families with fixed incomes, such as those on temporary assistance for needy families who would have to adjust utilities usage and food intake. The gap in health outcomes and health care use between high and low income people is growing. Less money for fixed expenses also means less for medical supplies or preventive care, leading to additional illnesses and decreased quality of life. Researchers found that U.S. adults living in poverty are more likely to report being in poor or fair health. About 19% of Boone County residents live in poverty, and about 17% of the eligible population under age 65 are uninsured. These two subgroups are more likely to have unmet health care needs and are less likely to have a usual primary care provider or continuous insurance coverage. The 2011 National Energy Assistance Survey found that as many as 37% of LIHEAP recipient households went without medical or dental care, while 34% did not fill a prescription or took less than their prescribed dose. Local energy assistance providers offered a number of examples about energy assistance recipients making health care-related trade-offs. The cost of a potential $2 to $4 utility fee could be the copay cost of medication or help pay for insulin needles, catheters, or colostomy bags, which sometimes people reuse because they can't afford new ones. A home is considered affordable if the occupier pays 30% or less of total household income on mortgage or rent plus utilities. A household is considered burdened if it pays over 30%. Research by University of Missouri students found that approximately 22% of homeowners in Columbia pay greater than 30% of total household income on mortgage costs, and 50% of renters pay more than 30%. Individuals and families in poverty spend a greater percentage of their incomes on energy than an average household. To compensate for additional fixed expenses, households will likely seek to lower their energy bills by relying on unsafe heating methods, such as space heaters, stoves, and wood. These heating sources pose potential safety hazards. Space heaters cause an estimated 25,000 residential fires each year, resulting in more than 300 deaths and over 6,000 emergency room visits due to burns. Additionally, gas stoves, wood stoves, and fireplaces release combustion pollutants into the home, which leads to both short- and long-term health problems, including respiratory diseases, neurological disorders, heart disease, and cancer. Key informants said that many households will simply go without heat during the winter. They rely on wearing winter clothes and sitting in front of a warm oven. One family placed space heaters at the bottom of their sleeping bags, while another cuddled with family pets. Some providers indicated that cooling issues are not nearly as severe as heating issues. However, households will not use cooling systems for fear of increasing their utility bills. They will often leave windows open, which allow allergens and other particulates into the home, along with increasing the risk for mold. The informants said increased competition for energy assistance funds causes additional mental stress. Families living in assisted housing need to have active utility service or they face eviction. They can apply to receive LIHEAP funding only if they've paid the other fees for trash, water, sewage, and other services such as the transportation utility fee. If residents are denied because of lack of funding, they're put on a wait list that can grow by as many as 100 families each day, depending on the season. Additionally, parents don't reach out for help because they're worried about losing custody of their children. Older adults don't tell their children about their financial problems because they're worried about being forced into nursing homes and losing their independence. The video we're about to show illustrates findings through our research and key informant interviews about the stresses and difficulties families face when household income is reduced. Families must make trade-offs in order to afford basic needs. Coming today to participate in our videos. The three of you are now a family. So what we're going to do is we're going to play a game. This is called the Bean Game. So I've already told you that you are a family now, okay? So what you're going to do is you're going to decide your family structure,
and the needs of your family as we get into the game. So what we have for you are cards. There are different spending categories that all families have. So anything from health care to transportation, housing, recreation, furniture, you name it, is in this set of cards. As a family, you're going to be given 25 beans. This is your money, okay? As a family, I would like you to work together and come to a consensus as to how you spend your beans to get what your family needs. For one bean, you might buy some cable TV, you might go to a movie, you might get a subscription to a magazine. For two beans, you might go to a concert, take a vacation, or go see a sporting event. So as a family, I'm going to ask you to spend your beans and think about what it is you need the most as a family, and then how you allocate those beans to get what it is that your family needs.
We have to have housing.
We have to have food. Housing and food.
Utilities.
Of course.
Okay, how about housing? Or live in public housing, share an apartment, rent your own place, or buy?
No, school and education.
But we need car repairs, yes, don't we?
Yes. Taxes. You got to have taxes on everything.
We're going to have to take seven beans away because one of you just lost a job.
We have five beans left.
And we still got to buy furniture, do our laundry, put something in savings.
Okay, so we got one there.
We got one here.
Well, you know what?
Okay, so for furniture,
I think we should sell the car.
You want to sell the car?
We're going to sell the car.
When we were saying, oh, you're going to take our beans, I mean, I think that creates that whole question in someone's mind, what comes next?
Right.
You know, and it puts you feeling, are we on the precipice? Are we, what's going to happen to kick us off to where we can't?
We don't have housing.
We don't have housing.
Something else is going to happen within that month where we're going to have to redo our beans again.
Yeah.
Well, you can't go to the doctors, you can't afford your medicine, and that leads to other health problems when you can't do preventative care.
In reality, most people don't have savings in the low income. Mm-hmm. A lot of them shop at secondhand clothing stores,
right. Mm-hmm.
And they wear a lot of hand-me-downs.
Mm-hmm.
I can go without food if I had to make sure she grew up to be strong.
What I learned from the game about allocating resources is that we had a set amount of beans to start with, and then it's kind of like all of a sudden, you know, a lot of them are gone, and then you kind of have to rethink how you would allocate your beans.
Well, during this scenario, and when my husband lost his job, and some of our beans was taken away, it put a lot of stress under the family.
It seemed to me that was something that I've seen happen too often, that, you know, families feel that first blow to security, and then everything's put at risk.
You have to be able to get to work. You have to be able to get to the doctor, the grocery store. You can't rely on friends to always get you where you need to go. They have emergencies that come up that they have to take care of. Walking in public transportation takes so much time. Sometimes it takes a whole morning or a whole afternoon just to go one place.
We didn't feel the bus could really get us to where we needed to go when we needed to get there. So we didn't have any choice but to have a car.
When we had to give up the beans for transportation, that's when I knew we were really in trouble. You lose so much of your independence if you don't have the means to travel from one spot to another. It's pretty dire.
I guess you have to reprioritize your budget and how you allocate, you know, what resources you have.
If I want this from the store, then this is going to take away from something else.
It's so fragile when you get down to very limited resources. It's so fragile, and one thing goes out of balance, the whole thing can fall.
Okay, now we'll transition into our recommendations and then close from there. The recommendations for this health impact assessment take into account research on the transportation utility fee, as well as data gathered in the community survey. Our first recommendation, if a transportation utility fee is determined to be a funding source, consider reducing or waiving the fee for low and fixed income populations. Number two, research alternative funding sources that have worked in other communities. Number three, further solicit community input on funding options when gathering data for public transit proposals. Number four, increase public outreach about the bus system. And number five, adjust the transit hours of operation to accommodate shift workers.
Further recommendations include to ensure that bus stops are located near healthy food options, healthcare facilities, neighborhood parks and recreation facilities, and social welfare and community services. Also create routes and timetables that are consistent and post them at all stops. Further, ensure the Columbia Transit website is timely and easy to navigate. 3/4 of respondents from our community survey indicated it is by far their most used source of information about the bus system. Finally, consider adding Sunday service, which would allow residents better access to the community.
As far as the next steps in the HAA, following HAA best practices, the partner team will conduct both a process and impact evaluation of the HAA to identify areas for future improvement and to monitor the implementation of included recommendations. Additionally, the partner team will communicate its findings through a full report and executive summary available on the Columbia Boone County Department of Public Health, Human Services, and Comet websites. We will also be presenting findings before other community groups. Just quickly, some limitations. The most significant limitation experienced was a short time frame in which the HAA was conducted. Most health impact assessments involve a period of months in which team members perform in-depth literature reviews, gather expert and stakeholder opinion, collect new primary data, and inform decision makers. However, the HAA partner team completed all these tasks using an expedited version called a rapid health impact assessment. In closing, a transportation utility fee added to households' rent or mortgage payments, along with energy expenses, would additionally drain limited income. For low and fixed income families, money for housing, food, and utilities is already limited so that any extra expenses threaten the residents' health and well-being. Therefore, it is important to note that the potential health effects of a transportation utility fee depend on the monthly amounts charged to residents and the potential induction of waivers or reduced fees for low and fixed income households. And at this time, we'd like to recognize the University of Missouri Extension for developing the bean game that you saw in the video this evening. And we'd also like to thank Tom Baker for his help in filming that exercise. So we'd like to go ahead and open up for any questions.
Council?
I have one question. In the literature, did you find anything about when transportation is improved and more accessible, that it actually helped people get to jobs and to doctors, and long term, it was beneficial?
Correct, and that's sort of dating back to our first health impact assessment, where we did look at how transit expansion would potentially have positive health benefits. So the literature, for that health impact assessment did show that there would be positive effects if we were able to expand transit, because residents would be able to access health care and food and et cetera.
Jason, the $2 to $4 per month utility fee increase, I think it was in here, but I couldn't just find it as I was looking. How much would that generate per year?
Yes.
For the transit budget?
Sure. It would generate about $3.7 million per year. The breakdown, I can give you a breakdown of the I believe it was 54% would be submitted by the by commercial properties, and then 46% would fall into households.
Right.
Million and 1.7 million.
$3.7 million. So that's somewhere in the range of a 50% to increase to a doubling of the current budget, somewhere in there, I think. So to kind of continue from Barbara's point, can you weigh how the health benefits of the expansion of transit weigh against the negative health impacts of the additional fee for low and fixed income families?
Sure. So we found through the first health impact assessment that it would be a sort of a long-term effect if you are, you know, expanding transit. So you would have, you know, greater opportunities for walking, for physical activity, more opportunities to find employment, things of that nature. So that would be sort of more long-term health impacts. With a transportation utility fee, that would be more short-term impacts because you're dealing with this utility fee each month. You know, you're having to sort of balance out your priorities, your income, whether you have enough money to pay utilities or go buy food. So that's a little bit more, the health effects will be a little bit more immediate than actually expanding.
And were the negative health impacts that you found primarily accruing to low and fixed income families?
Through the literature, that is what we found. We're not sure if that would, you know, creep into sort of the middle class or not. But again, there's sort of that fine line that, you know, anything could happen on a month-to-month basis. You know, husband, wife lose their job, anything like that could, you know, plunge you sort of from that middle income down to low income.
I would point to the research that the University of Missouri students have done. They perhaps have more of a breakdown of the income of households that are burdened and are paying more than 30% of their total income for housing. So there might be some data in there that we could point to.
Couple of observations here. I first heard about health impact assessments about 2008, I think. It was at a meeting in San Diego of the Partners for Smart Growth. And it was mostly Canadian phenomenon, and it was just starting to catch hold in the United States. And I was glad to see that we were graced with the grant to proceed with this. It seems to me that what's striking to me is something that I've been talking about a little bit on another level, and that is this user-based fee idea based on trip generation or based on impact. I was describing it before at the retreat that the City Council had in terms of transportation infrastructure, but this is kind of central to this issue as well, that is transportation infrastructure as it affects low-income folks. And interestingly, the reports that were generated both recommended exclusions for low-income, the same kind of finding that you just found with these health impact assessments. Seems to me that some of the low-hanging fruit here, aside from housing and the cost of transportation, the things that are that with the exercise that you demonstrated that people forego are primarily related to energy, are related to you know, they sleep with heaters at the end of their bed, or they sleep with their pets, or they do that kind of thing. It's the utility bills that really make a huge impact on how this whole health assessment thing fits, even in the context of transportation, and I would submit that's an area that we really ought to focus on. This thing about and that's coming up actually. So the international building codes are coming up. There are several areas in which we can help this situation with the health impact assessment and the transit idea of it in the context of dealing with some of the energy issues that people have to deal with or forego if they don't have to deal with them. Am I missing that? I mean, does this seem to be consistent with some of the other issues that we're talking about in terms of user-based fees and trip generation and impact and all that kind of
thing? That's correct. So through the literature, we did find that low-income households, and really all households, sort of prioritize having, you know, a roof above your head first, then food, and then they sort of prioritize utilities and everything else, you know, below that. And other models, the transportation utility fee is really popular out in Oregon, and through all the research we did there, there are a lot of waivers, you know, for low-income households that meet certain income thresholds or if they've had a crisis or something of that nature. So, yeah, it is consistent.
Thank you.
Do we have any examples already of waivers to any utility fees we're currently charging? I know we have the cash and help programs for low-income families from utility bills. Is there an example of a specific waiver that people qualify for? What do you know?
Whether, I guess there are reduced fees, transit fees. I mean, there are those kinds of things, and I guess you could look at them in terms of some sort of, it's not a waiving of the fee entirely, but it's a reduction of the fees, I think.
That's true. I was really thinking on the utility bills people receive.
And the waivers that we found were generally short-term, so they were about maybe a year, and then they would come back and reevaluate whether they still fell into that waiver category.
Mm-hmm.
We have two other topics. Any other comments in summary by anybody?
Should definitely give us pause before we raise taxes, increase people's utility bills, and anything like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Yeah,
thank you. Thanks, Jason and Lisa.
Next item is relating to House Bill 253, consideration of a position on a governor's veto, and Tony Messina is here to walk us through the thinking and the request on this item.
Well, speaking of taxes, that's what this bill is about. It combines significant income tax cuts for businesses and individuals with the streamlined sales and use tax agreement, two things that taken together could have an effect on revenue collections locally and at the state level. The Missouri Municipal League, which is made up of member cities, Columbia is one of the members, is asking its membership to sustain the governor's veto of this bill. And recognizing that council members as individuals may have very different views on this, staff is offering some information for your thoughts and consideration here this evening. To put this in very broad terms, there appears to be a couple of different positions on the level of risk associated with this bill. Supporters of the bill would say we risk losing businesses to other states if we don't make these significant income tax cuts, and increased economic activity that could flow from those tax cuts could increase our revenue collections overall because of additional economic activity. The governor and the people who oppose this bill would say there's so much uncertainty. We believe that this is going to result in a lot of lost revenue that could affect primarily higher education, local schools, and vital core services like public safety and health. So from council standpoint, I think the question is, as a group, do you agree that one sort of risk outweighs the other? At this time, I'm not aware that there is enough House members to override the governor's veto. They need 109 votes. In Columbia, it kind of broke down by party lines during the original vote, although Representative Kelly was absent with leave because of health reasons for the final vote in the House. There is one individual, Representative Rowden, who is said to be still considering his position. He originally voted for the bill, but what I've read in the news media is that he may have some concerns about how this affects the educational establishment in Columbia.
What's the position of the other local legislators?
Senator Schaefer supports the bill, as does Representative Caleb Jones. Representatives Weber and Wright oppose the bill, and I'm going to guess that even though he didn't vote on the bill, that Representative Kelly would also vote to sustain the governor's veto.
So it's party line.
It is.
I am aware that the university is opposed to the bill strongly. And I attended a chamber of governmental affairs meeting on Friday where this was discussed at the chamber level with great interest on the economic impact to Columbia of governor's veto being overturned. And basically, they didn't know what to do. They were uncertain. And I'm operating out of a high level of uncertainty, too. At a very superficial level, I take what the university says at face value, but I haven't examined it. But they are the economic driver for the city of Columbia. And
So at face value, I tend to back their recommendation. I don't know how much, how helpful that is to our delegation at large.
Well, I belong to the Chamber Government Affairs Committee. I missed that meeting, actually. I wish I had not.
This is a board meeting.
This is a board meeting. That's a different. Yeah. That's not the Government Affairs Committee meeting. At any rate, I'm sure they're uncertain as well. Because, and I think the key here is this: that what you just suggested, that there, that is, some of the folks that have lined up here are suggesting that this could increase. That's kind of a question mark in terms of
in terms
of the evidence that is available to on one side or the other. And I think that's as I read it, that's where the governor is coming down. He was giving a list of things that it may damage. But this is all contingent upon whether or not the balance is, whether revenues could increase in the face of these other things. So as an individual council member, I'm not shy about giving my support to opposing or supporting the governor's veto on this. I don't know how the rest of the council feels about this. And I think that the university is probably considering a lot of these things, as is the chamber. And if the chamber doesn't automatically come down against some of these things, it suggests to me that there is some wiggle room here. I would encourage the council to send in some support for the governor's veto, but that is entirely up to the rest of the council.
Well, I think we ought to do it individually, because I think most of us are not, once again, my position is that I tend to back the university in their analysis, but I've not seen a formal letter.
Right.
I've not seen a formal position on the part of the university. So we're dealing with something really kind of indirectly. None of us have spoken to our legislators. None of us have talked to university administration about this.
Well, actually, some of us have.
Well, but again, I think if you want to write a letter of concern about the its effect on the economic impact on education in Columbia, I'm reluctant to say anything stronger personally.
Well, I'm just going to, I think, reiterate what has been said so far. I've cautioned against this before, is the City Council, we have so much on our plate for us to deal with here locally. To start getting involved in state and federal issues, I think, overstretches us, and I think there's nothing that prohibits us in an individual capacity as a representative of our ward, and use our official letterhead, to write a letter to the governor or whomever on any issue. And so that is the position I would like to take on some of these things, is to handle this individually with your constituents and your philosophical belief, unless it's something, directly that impacts the city of Columbia, rather than something that's so broad that impacts the entire state.
I agree completely.
Tony, are there any specific impacts that you can foresee on the City of Columbia's budget, on grants or funding from the state that might make a difference if this bill were to pass, difference to the city?
I have to be honest, I can't say specifically that there are. And a lot of the analysis involved questions that the bill raised. So that's a problem.
Our middle way may be
to, this has got a lot of complexity to it. There are issues where we would be in more or less unanimous agreement, where the impact would be a lot clearer, that we might, where there would be little disagreement about chiming in as a group or on behalf of the city. Whereas this one seems a little, this is a confusing, complex piece of legislation.
It's certainly acceptable to me for individuals to chime in any way they feel about it. I mean, I'm not terribly shy about the council as a whole expressing their opinions on political issues, if that's what the council thinks is reasonable. But if there are differences of opinions, as some of the folks have suggested here, for a complex issue, and there's no reason why we just simply can't do it on an individual basis on that.
I'm supportive of the veto, but individual letters are acceptable, and it seems like it's maybe the better way to go for council.
I sense a consensus.
I think there may be circumstances. I can imagine circumstances where there is a threat directed to the city of Columbia that is so concerning that we really would want to write a letter to the governor or to the legislature or to somebody else. But I don't think this is it, and I think probably those circumstances should be kept to a minimum, just to the most extreme threats.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And the next item?
The next item, I'll ask Phil Steinhaus to come speak with us about the Columbia Housing Authority Rental Assistance Demonstration Program.
Good evening. Phil Steinhaus, Columbia Housing Authority, offices at 201 Switzer Street. Appreciate your time tonight. I know we've got a long meeting, and we have several items on the agenda later on that are related to the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. I wanted to take a few minutes, and I appreciate your time to allow me to do that, because this is really a fundamental change in the way the Housing Authority will be funded by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. So the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program is a pilot program offered by HUD, 60,000 units nationwide, so it's a pretty small demonstration program. We have submitted our application to convert from our current public housing operating subsidy, and it'll be that. And what I'll show you a little bit, and you've got a copy of the memo that I sent to you, hopefully, and what the RAD program will do will allow us to convert our public housing operating subsidy and capital fund over to what they call project-based vouchers. So I think you're familiar with the Section 8 program, which is really the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Within the Section 8 program, there are allowances to actually, instead of connecting that housing voucher to a person, is to actually connect it to a property, and those are called project-based vouchers. It comes under a different section, so actually that's where Section 8 comes from. Public housing is actually Section 9. So there's two different funding streams that come in for two different housing assistance programs. Public housing was kind of the first iteration of federal housing policy, and then the Section 8 program came along in the mid to late 70s to give people more choices about housing and where they could have housing instead of concentrating the poorest of poor all in one area. What they've realized, though, there we go. Great. Thank you, sir. Is that that doesn't always work for families to concentrate them all in one area, and so the Section 8 program gave people more choices out in the community. They also realized, though, that you could project-base some of these in order to increase capacity out in certain areas. What has happened, though, over time is that the Columbia Housing Authority and public housing in general, I'm not sure, pushed the wrong button here. Oh. So public housing has kind of been left in the dust a little bit, and so what has happened is that with regards to our public housing operating subsidies, they prorate those every year, so sequestration is not really anything new to us. They calculate our operating subsidy, and then they say, well, you only get 80% this year, or you get 85% this year, or you get 70% this year. And so it's constantly fluctuating on us, and it's been decreasing over time. We basically receive two streams of funds that support public housing, and those are our operating subsidies and our capital fund. So I think this chart kind of basically gives you a good breakdown of how it works. You'll see if we were to take the revenues that we receive from public housing and divide that out over, so this would be an example of $600 a month for one housing unit to support that. It will be made up of three things. It will be made up of our operating fund, our capital fund. Capital fund obviously is the investment they make year after year so we can replace roofs and do major repairs. And then we collect rent from our tenants. So the tenant rent would not change under this program. They would still pay 30% of their adjusted household income for rent. So you can see in this model, the tenant still pays $110, which is about average of our public housing residents in our family sites. And then the conversion would take basically the operating fund and the capital fund and convert that into a long-term contract which is called a housing assistance payment contract, and that's the terminology that's used in the Section 8 program. So, for example, with Section 8, the way it works is if you're the landlord, someone comes to you with a voucher and says, I'd like to rent your place, you say, okay, you hook up with the housing authority, the tenant pays their share, and we pay the balance through a housing assistance payment. So in this conversion model, then what would happen is that the housing authority is still the landlord of our property, but now we're going to receive that housing assistance payment through the Section 8 program rather than a combination of operating fund and the capital fund. The benefit to this is that they will lock that in for a 20-year contract with us at the rate that we were receiving in 2012. So this year, we've already received a reduced operating fund subsidy. You may have seen in the paper the other day, we just got another cut in our capital fund, cut by 10%, lost $100,000 this year from what we received last year. We're down almost $50,000 or $500,000 from what we were first funded in the year 2000. Past 12 years, it's decreased over 26%. So you can imagine if you're a private landlord and your rents keep going down and your maintenance costs keep going up, you're going to be in trouble. So what RAD does is allows us to enter into a long-term contract. And why this is important is that public housing and HUD has recognized that Congress is not going to continue to allocate more money to the capital fund, so they're going to give housing authorities the opportunity to go out and try to leverage other funds in the community to renovate, support, and preserve their housing. So what happens, though, is if we go out after the major funding stream, which is low-income housing tax credits, the investors that invest in those tax credits want to see that we've got a stable financial model. So when they look at our budget and they want to see our 20-year budget, we say, well, this year we got 80%, next year we might get 85%, but we don't know what we're going to get the year after that. Then the financial model becomes unstable and the investors won't invest in renovating public housing. So HUD has recognized this model, and so that they have allowed the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program to basically allow housing authorities to convert over to a long-term stable contract where rents are necessary for applying for these low-income housing tax credits. So the beauty of the program is the tenants, our residents, they won't notice any difference. Their rent will still be calculated the same. If they lose their job, they come tell us, we lower their share, we increase our share, and HUD just reimburses us at this locked-in contract rent. So the risk for us is that if all of a sudden they started increasing public housing subsidies year after year after year, and we'd be locked in at this 2012 rent. But what we see is from history is that they've continued to decrease funding for public housing operating subsidy and cut the capital fund. So what we know is that our aging public housing units need a lot of work, particularly our downtown units. And if we don't do anything about it, we're going to lose this important housing resource, and we're going to continue to battle high maintenance costs. So when we submit an application to participate in the RAD program, we have to show evidence that our application is feasible. So we have to show that we can not only leverage low-income housing tax credits, but the rent that we're going to be locked into, that we can also leverage some conventional mortgage money in order to make all this work, because tax credits will not pay for all of it. They pay for part of it, and then we still have to go out and get money out there on the regular market. So we have to identify potential lenders or investors that are willing to invest in this project. This is rather new across the nation, but we have identified some potential lenders and investors. We also have to inform the residents and make sure that they understand the program and the protections that are offered. Once we're approved, we'll receive a RAD award letter that will give us a commitment to enter into a housing assistance payment contract. And it's called a CHAP. And what they're basically saying is, we will commit, if you can leverage some tax credits, we'll commit to this conversion. If you don't get the tax credits, then the deal's off. So our risk here is basically, if we don't get the low-income housing tax credits to renovate public housing, then it's just all the work we put into the application just went down the tubes. Nothing will change. We'll still operate on public housing subsidy, and we'll continue to operate that way until the conversion is complete. We have to do a physical conditions assessment, meaning we have to show, as part of this plan, that we have gone through all our properties and determined what all needs to be done. So we can't just say, give us some money and we'll do something. We have to say, this is our plan. We're going to bring them up to snuff. This is everything that needs to be done, and this is how the financial model works. So we've been putting a lot of time and effort into laying this plan, and as you've seen later on in the agenda, we're asking for your approval of our tax credit applications later on in the meeting. Good things about RAD is there are a lot of tenant protections. There's no rescreening of tenants. They have the right to return. With our downtown family units, we're going to be having to do some major renovations to those units, so we'll have to ask people to move out for a short period of time, and we'll take care of all their relocation costs. The renewal of the lease is automatic, so when they come back in, we can't just say, oh, well, we're not going to renew your lease. So any kind of tenant rent increases have to be phased in. So there are a lot of protections that are built in for residents. Also, some of the resident participation and resident services funding is built in. Probably the most important, though, is because these become now project-based vouchers, they get an added benefit, which is called resident choice and mobility, which means after they've lived there for a year, if they say at the end of their lease, I don't want to renew my lease, I would rather have a voucher, we will give them a voucher and they can move with assistance. So now instead of trapping people in one area, which is what really kind of happens now, is with our Section 8 waiting list, it's only open for a week about every 2 years. And so we took 1,500 names last September, and we're still working through that list. So people move into public housing because those waiting lists are open. They move in, they wait till the Section 8 list comes up. They apply for Section 8 voucher. They wait maybe another year or two until their voucher comes up, so it might take them a couple of years if they need to move to another community or another area of town to be in a different school district, be near a family member, be better placed towards a job. So this gives people resident choice and mobility. And frankly, when all our residents heard about that, they really liked that option. So we do know that 46% of the people living downtown applied for a voucher last September. So we do know that people want a housing voucher. We also know that one of the reasons they want a voucher is because they can get a better plumbing system, they can get a dishwasher, they can get a ceiling fan, they can get a lot of the amenities out there that are in normal rental properties that we just don't offer because our properties are 50 years old and they need to be updated and maintained. So that's what our primary focus is the 294 public housing units that are downtown. What we realized on the RAD program, talking with them, is they said, you want to convert all your units. It's your benefit to convert all your units because you lock into a stable financial formula. And in fact, you can bundle properties together. And so that's what our first plan is. As you know, we've made many improvements to Paquin Towers over the last several years, geothermal system, new windows, new roofs, all sorts of things with some of our stimulus grants. And so we can bundle 84 units downtown with our 200 units in Paquin Towers and make a 4% tax credit deal work because Paquin Tower units need very little upkeep. And so we can bring the unit cost down and make those work. And so they advised us to actually develop a plan to renovate all 719 units of public housing and do our worst ones, which are public housing. Bear Creek was built in 78. They don't need as much renovation. Oak Towers needs more than Paquin, but there are several projects that we think we can work. So this will take about five phases. It'll take 6 to 7 years to go through and complete all these projects. And I know it's a little complicated, and I'm talking really fast. So I did want to just kind of show you this chart. I know it's maybe a little hard to read, but hopefully you've got it in front of you. This kind of lays out our plan here, and you can see we've got basically laid out the five phases. So the first one would be a combination of the 84 units up on Lincoln, Unity, Oak, Worley, and Hicks, and those are family site units, and then be combined with Paquin Towers, which needs really modest renovations. We would go in and gut the units up there on public house up on Lincoln and Unity in that area. We're calling that Stuart Parker. That was actually the original project name of those units up there. Some of you might know the history of public housing. They was developed by a series of projects, and each project had a name. So we're going back to the traditional name. So when you hear Stuart Parker used, it will actually be encompassing Paquin Towers, but we will not take away Paquin Towers' name. So that would be our first phase. The next one would be Bear Creek and Oak Towers combined together. And then we would complete three more projects downtown, 70 units each, to complete our 719 units. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know I went through that pretty quick. Here's Stuart Parker units, but essentially what it does is puts us on a more stable funding platform that allows us now to go out and leverage low-income housing tax credits for these much-needed renovations.
Mr. Mayor, just a question. Just a question. You mentioned the resident mobility. That seems like a
right.
good thing, and that's what a lot of these folks are fond of this. And you mentioned that there is the upside, which is that you're locked into 20 years. That's also the downside. You're locked in 20 years. Mm-hmm. What else is there in the downside? Is it just the fact that it could be more advantageous if you weren't locked into this to get something out of this? It's not likely. I understand that.
Yeah. I'm not really seeing a downside to it. It's probably the biggest downside is the low-income housing tax credit deals are complicated. They involve a lot of attorneys. We have to set up a separate not-for-profit. We'll lease the land underneath the buildings. We'll actually sell the buildings to the not-for-profit, which allows us to take that tax credit benefit and make the renovations.
So some of the shift is shifted towards the local area rather than the federal area?
That's right. The benefit for us is really we become more like a private landlord on these properties, and so there are a lot of things right now, regulations with public housing, I'm sure Mr. Mathis is aware of, just all sorts of extra regulations that go with public housing that will free us up from some of that. And so we'll, what they're really doing is trying to make us move towards more like what the private market is. Mm-hmm. And they're also saying that your units need to compete. We're going to have a hard time managing public housing if nobody wants to live there. If, because they're so old and outdated, people move there only because that's their only choice. And as soon as they get a voucher, they're out. So what we want to do is renovate these units so everybody says, wow, this is great. And I think one of the things that Columbia has going for it that a lot of other communities don't is that when urban renewal came in and public housing was built in a lot of these communities, it replaced housing that was located in a bad section of town to begin with. So it was on the wrong side of the proverbial track, so to speak. So now you built it. It was maybe in an industrial area. It was not in the best location, located close to goods and services, transportation, education, other things like that. And so your public housing didn't work that well for families. We were really lucky because when they came in and replaced, urban renewal came in and built public housing, you know, that was a muddy road down there. Flat Branch ran right through that area. It was a place that was not super habitable, but now it's really been fixed up, and our downtown units are located in a great part of town. Our residents have great access to the university, Columbia College, downtown, goods and services, transportation, everything. So what better place? We don't really want to do affordable housing so far out of town that people don't have the access. It ties right into your previous conversation about health impact and transportation and all those other things, and housing's number one. Did that answer your question? I rambled a bit.
Yes, it did answer my question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's take 5 minutes and start promptly at 7:05 on the meeting.